welcome to the Community Mennonite Church Podcast. This week's sermon is brought to us by Pastor Dana Olson Getty.
Please pray with me. O Lord, open my lips that I may proclaim your word. Open our hearts that your spirit may speak. Amen. In the book, The Spacious Heart, Room for Spiritual Awakening, the Mennonite poet and spiritual director Sharon Clymer Landis makes this startling claim. Our stories are as sacred to God, she says, as God's stories are as sacred to us. She admits that when she first heard this idea, she found it a little scandalous and intriguing. But she goes on to write, as she began to practice reverence and a deeper attentiveness toward her own story, her own life, and towards those of others around her, she became convinced that this is true. That our stories are as sacred to God as God's stories are to us. And through this practice, she found a new understanding that as we understand our lives and our stories to be sacred, she found healing for herself, and she found a new capacity to extend healing to others. So these stories that we've been listening to in 1 Samuel are stories that might seem too ordinary to be sacred stories to those who are first experiencing them. They're stories about politics and economics and kings and wars. And they come at a time in Israel's history when God's presence in their story was more difficult to see than it had been in the past. They had these series of miraculous events. They were led out of slavery in Egypt by the parting of the Great Sea. They were cared for 40 years in the desert. They were led into Canaan and given their own homeland. But now they're in a new, settled chapter of their life. And instead of a daily flurry of manna and quail, God provides for them through the birth of a child to a formerly barren woman. Instead of a pillar of fire and cloud, God speaks through a voice calling to a small boy in the night, through a prophet's horn of oil. So in this new settled chapter of life, when God seems less visible, less present, God's people start to feel a little anxious. So Samuel is their leader. He's led them since Eli's death, but he's really old, and everybody knows that his sons are incredibly corrupt. And the people are concerned about their future. So their neighbors, the Philistines, they had a corner on the iron market, which meant they had all sorts of amazing military weapons that the Israelites didn't have. And a leadership vacuum during a turnover might be just the opportunity that those Philistines needed to come in and take over the Israelites. These Israelites needed a solid leadership succession plan. That's what they needed. They're no longer a wandering tribal people. They're established. They have a homeland and borders to care about. They need a more centralized modern model of government, one with a strong military defense and a highly visible commander who has the gravitas befitting a representative of their nation. And so these people who have been living in this land demand a king. And there's only one small problem with this. Out of all the peoples in the world, God has chosen them, and God has said that God will personally be their king. It's God who rescued them out of slavery, God who provides for their security and their flourishing. It's God who represents them among other nations. And so when the people say, we want a human king, they're actually repudiating God's kingship. This may sound very rational and reasonable, but it's actually a very direct insult and rejection of God. So God, through Samuel, gives them a very stern warning about the dangers and pitfalls of swearing loyalty to a human king. But surprisingly, God actually gives them what they ask for. God gives them a king. They're given a king. He's a tall, handsome young man from a leading Israelite family. And the prophet Samuel anoints this young man named Saul, and he begins his rule by leading the people in an overwhelming military victory. But it's not very long until we start to get hints that not everything is as well with Israel as you might think. So Samuel gives a farewell speech. He's officially turning over the leadership of the country to Saul. And in this speech, he chastises the Israelites for the evil that they've done in demanding a king. He warns them if they persist in doing evil, both they and their king will perish. And yet, nearly in the same breath, Samuel reassures them. He says, "Do not be afraid. For the sake of his great name, the Lord will not reject his people, because the Lord was pleased to make you his own." And so in the chapters that follow, we see both of these unfold: Saul's failure as king, and then also God's continued faithfulness in the midst of this failure. So at first, you might think Saul was a success as a king. He did astoundingly well as a military commander. But he fatally overestimated his own importance and authority. He was a religious man. He made sure to accommodate the ritual worship needs of his soldiers and to fulfill them himself. But when he's preparing for a battle and the priest takes too long to show up for the pre-battle sacrifice, he decides to take matters into his own hands and do that sacrifice himself. And then in another battle, despite clear instructions that he's not supposed to spare any lives, I don't know what we make of that as Mennonites, Saul decides he knows better, and he keeps back some of the best of everything for a private post-battle sacrifice, which he plans to hold just as soon as he finishes erecting a statue in his own honor. So God is not pleased with this king. God is not pleased with his self-important governing. And it's clear that if the Israelites are going to continue to be God's people and not Saul's people, that something has got to change. And so God intervenes on Israel's behalf. Now, at this point in the story, if I were in God's shoes, you would probably hear me muttering something like, "I am so done with this. I wash my hands of this mess. Let them figure it out." But that is not what God does. Even in the face of Israel's rejection of God and God's kingship, in the face of this self-inflated, grandiose king who thinks he can take God's place, God remains faithful to God's covenant promises. God continues to act on Israel's behalf and to provide for their well-being. And the place where God acts on their behalf is right smack in the middle of their failure. So rather than washing his hands of them, as I would have done, God envisions a way forward for Israel that's right in the heart of the mess and the failure that they have created. This is how God does it. Despite the fact that Saul is still reigning as king, God sends Samuel on a covert mission in search of a new king. This new king is the eighth son of Jesse. He's a sheep farmer from Bethlehem. Jesse is the grandson of Ruth, who was a Moabite, and of Boaz. So Samuel shows up at the home of Jesse, and he asks Jesse to gather his sons. But when this story begins, there are only seven sons present. And one by one by one, these young men stand before Samuel. And one by one by one, God says, "Nope, not this one. Nope, not this one. Nope, not this one." And then finally, Samuel has run out of sons. I imagine he probably stood there a little dumbfounded, wondering, If he'd somehow misheard, maybe he needs to clean out his ears. Maybe he should start this whole lineup over again and begin at the beginning. But he asks Jesse, are there any more sons? And it turns out there's one more. He's so young and insignificant, Jesse hadn't even called him to this family meeting. He's out taking care of the sheep. But Jesse sends someone to get him, and he arrives, and Samuel knows this one. The barefoot one who smells like sheep manure and sweat. This is the one through whom God is going to intervene in Israel's failure. This is the one through whom God will provide a way forward. Despite Israel's treacherous rejection of God, this one has a heart for God. And despite terrible choices of his own, which he will make, this is the one who will continue Israel's covenant relationship with God. And he'll do it right in the midst of the failure that Israel has chosen. He'll do it as their king. So one of the things I noticed as I was reading and rereading this story is how very attentive the narrators are to where God is at work in Israel's history. You could easily narrate these stories as secular events, as secular history, right? You wouldn't need to necessarily name God's presence at their heart in order to explain the outward events. But these narrators are listening closely and deeply to their own story for signs of God's presence. They are listening with faith that their stories are sacred stories, that their stories are full of the sometimes hidden but life-changing presence of God. And because these narrators listen closely, carefully, attentively for God's presence in their ordinary life stories, they can tell us about God's redemption and healing at the very heart of Israel's rejection of God. They know that that shepherd boy being anointed isn't just a future king. He's a sign of God's unfailing covenant love. He's a sign that God will continue to pursue Israel, making a new way forward at the very heart of their sin. He's a sign that God will continue to pursue us, to bring redemption and healing in the heart of our most shameful, painful stories of sin and failure and loss. I think that Sharon Clymer Landis is right. I think our stories are full of the quiet and sometimes hidden, sometimes hard to see, but life-changing presence of God. And I think even those stories that flood us with shame or twist our stomach with regret, even those stories are sacred, are holy to God. Our stories are sacred because we are there and God is there. And it's in the stories of our lives where we meet God. It's where God brings redemption and new possibilities right in the heart of our worst failures, right in the heart of the things that we wish more than anything we could undo. God brings healing and God brings a way forward. These stories are where we experience God's unfailing covenant love, even if we have made less than ideal or even terrible choices, or even if we have suffered terrible things through no fault of our own. This is where God's life springs forth. And if that's true, then the practice of telling our stories to each other and listening attentively to each other's stories is a really vital spiritual practice. It's something that we need to practice doing because it's how we hear and see God's presence. We need space and time to listen to our own story, to the stories of those who are close to us, to the ordinary events of our lives. But we really only can do this kind of honest and vulnerable telling when we have relationships with a mutual commitment to this kind of listening, to hold our stories as something holy, as something sacred. This practice of mutually attentive listening lets us see where God is present. But it's not an easy practice for most of us. It requires the kind of reverence and attentiveness that Sharon Clymer Landis describes. And that requires putting aside our impulses to give advice, form an opinion, think about what the person could have done better or should do better next time, to make suggestions. Those are impulses we all have, but this kind of reverent, attentive listening asks us to put those aside. It's listening that requires us to open our hearts to the pain and grief of another without judgment, trusting that God is present, and that the very act of attentive listening for God's presence is what is most needed in that moment. This is one of the reasons that small groups are so important in our church. They are a space where we covenant together to listen well to each other's stories, week after week, month after month, to listen together for where God is present in the everyday, ordinary, easily explainable events of our lives, because we believe that those events are full of the presence of God. Small groups are a place where we can honestly tell our stories, the joyful ones, the painful ones, the ordinary everyday ones. And in that space, we can ask, where is God at work in my life? Where is God at work in our life together? Is there a sign of a new way forward, maybe even at the very heart of the thing that is most difficult and most painful, even at the heart of my failure? What would it mean for God to continue to respond to me with faithful covenant love? Can I receive that? Can I see it? These are not easy questions, and they don't have easy answers. But listening for the answers is a gift in itself. It helps us receive our own lives as holy, as places where God meets us in life-changing ways. So today, as we continue to remember those who've gone before us and to celebrate All Saints' Day, hear this good news. We, all of us, are saints too. We are God's holy ones, chosen and beloved, and our lives are filled with the often hidden but transformative presence of God's love.
Listening to the Community Mennonite Church podcast. Our theme music is a setting of John Wesley's text, Jesus, I Believe You're Near, composed by Matt Carlson. Jeremy Nafziger arranged it for strings. To learn more about our congregation or to plan a visit, please check out our website at cmcva.org.